He stopped walking, faced us, and, newly energized, exclaimed that this incident, the assegai striking the wire, symbolized the clash between the culture of Africa and that of Europe. His voice rose, and he said, "The assegai stands for what is glorious and true in African history. It is a symbol of the African as warrior and the African as artist. This metal wire," he said, pointing above, "is an example of Western manufacturing, which is skillful but cold, clever but soulless. What I am talking about," he continued, "is not a piece of bone touching a piece of metal, or even the overlapping of one culture and another. What I am talking to you about is the brutal clash between what is indigenous and good and what is foreign and bad. We cannot allow these foreigners who do not care for our culture to take over our nation. I predict that one day the forces of African society will achieve a momentous victory over the interloper. For too long we have succumbed to the false gods of the white man. But we will emerge and cast off these foreign notions." I could hardly believe my ears. His boldness in speaking of such delicate matters in the presence of Dr. Wellington and other whites seemed utterly astonishing to us. Yet, at the same time, it aroused and motivated us, and began to alter my perception of men like Dr. Wellington, whom I had automatically considered my benefactor. Nkaye then began to recite his well-known poem in which he apportions the stars in the heavens to the various nations of the world. I had never before heard it. Roving the stage and gesturing with his assegai toward the sky, he said that to the people of Europe, the French, the Germans, the English, "I give you the Milky Way, the largest constellation, for you are a strange people full of greed and envy, who quarrel over plenty." He allocated certain stars to the Asian nations and to North and South America. He then discussed Africa and separated the continent into different nations, giving specific constellations to different tribes. He had been dancing about the stage, waving his spear, modulating his voice, and now, suddenly, he became still and lowered his voice. "Now come you, O house of Xhosa," he said, and slowly began to lower himself so that he was on one knee. "I give unto you the most important and transcendent star, the morning star, for you are a proud and powerful people. It is the star for counting the years of manhood." When he spoke this last word, he dropped his head to his chest. We rose to our feet, clapping and cheering. I did not want ever to stop applauding. I felt such intense pride at that point, not as an African, but as a Xhosa. I felt like one of the chosen people. I was galvanized, but also confused by Nkaye's performance. He had moved from a more nationalistic, all-encompassing theme of African unity to a more parochial one addressed to the Xhosa people, of whom he was one. As my time at Healtown was coming to an end, I had many new and sometimes conflicting ideas floating in my head. I was beginning to see that Africans of all tribes had much in common, yet here was the great Nkaye praising the Xhosa above all. I saw that an African might stand his ground with a white man, yet I was still eagerly seeking benefits from whites, which often required subservience. In a sense, Nkaye's shift in focus was a mirror of my own mind, because I went back and forth between pride in myself as a Xhosa and a feeling of kinship with other Africans. But as I left Healtown at the end of the year, I saw myself as a Xhosa first, and an African second. Chapter 7. Until 1960, the University College of Fort Hare in the municipality of Alice, about 20 miles due east from Healtown, was the only residential center of higher education for blacks in South Africa. Fort Hare was more than that. It was a beacon for African scholars from all over southern, central, and eastern Africa. For young black South Africans like myself, it was Oxford and Cambridge, Harvard and Yale all rolled into one. The regent was anxious for me to attend Fort Hare, and I was gratified to be accepted there. Before I went up to the university, the regent bought me my first suit. Double-breasted and grey, the suit made me feel grown up and sophisticated. I was 21 years old and could not imagine anyone at Fort Hare smarter than I. I felt that I was being groomed for success in the world. I was pleased that the regent would now have a member of his clan with a university degree. Justice had remained at Healdtown to pursue his junior certificate. He enjoyed playing more than studying and was an indifferent scholar. Fort Hare had been founded in 1916 by Scottish missionaries on the site of what was the largest 19th century frontier fort in the Eastern Cape.
Built on a rocky platform and moated by the winding arc of the Tayum River, Fort Hare was perfectly situated to enable the British to fight the gallant Xhosa warrior Sandile, the last Raharbe king, who was defeated by the British in one of the final frontier battles in the 1800s.
Fort Hare had only 150 students, and I already knew a dozen or so of them from Clarkbury and Healdtown. One of them, whom I was meeting for the first time, was K.D. Matanzima. Though K.D. was my nephew, according to tribal hierarchy, I was younger and far less senior to him. Tall and slender and extremely confident, K.D. was a third-year student, and he took me under his wing. I looked up to him as I had to Justice. We were both Methodists, and I was assigned to his hostel, known as Wesley House, a pleasant two-story building on the edge of the campus. Under his tutelage, I attended church services with him at nearby Loveday, took up soccer, in which he excelled, and generally followed his advice. The regent did not believe in sending money to his children at school, and I would have had empty pockets had not K.D. shared his allowance with me. Like the regent, he saw my future role as counselor to Sabata, and he encouraged me to study law. Fort Hare, like Clarkbury and Healdtown, was a missionary college. We were exhorted to obey God, respect the political authorities, and be grateful for the educational opportunities afforded to us by the church and the government. These schools have often been criticized for being colonialist in their attitudes and practices. Yet, even with such attitudes, I believe their benefits outweighed their disadvantages. The missionaries built and ran schools when the government was unwilling or unable to do so. The learning environment of the missionary schools, while often morally rigid, was far more open than the racist principles underlying government schools. Fort Hare was both home and incubator of some of the greatest African scholars the continent has ever known. Professor Z.K. Matthews was the very model of the African intellectual. A child of a miner, Z.K. had been influenced by Booker Washington's autobiography, Up from Slavery, which preached success through hard work and moderation. He taught social anthropology and law and bluntly spoke out against the government's social policies. Fort Hare and Professor D.D.T. Jabavu are virtually synonymous. He was the first member of the staff when the university opened in 1916. Professor Jabavu had been awarded a baccalaureate in English at the University of London, which seemed an impossibly rare feat. Professor Jabavu taught Xhosa as well as Latin, history, and anthropology. He was an encyclopedia when it came to Xhosa genealogy and told me facts about my father that I had never known. He was also a persuasive spokesman for African rights, becoming the founding president of the All-African Convention in 1936, which opposed legislation in Parliament designed to end the common voter's role in the Cape. I recall once traveling from Fort Hare to Umtata by train, riding in the African compartment, which were the only seats open to blacks. The white train conductor came to check our tickets. When he saw that I had gotten on at Alice, he said, "Are you from Jabavu's school?" I nodded, "Yes," whereupon the conductor cheerfully punched my ticket and mumbled something about Jabavu being a fine man. In my first year, I studied English, anthropology, politics, native administration, and Roman Dutch law. Native administration dealt with the laws relating to Africans and was advisable for anyone who wanted to work in the Native Affairs Department. Although KD was counseling me to study law, I had my heart set on being an interpreter or a clerk in the Native Affairs Department. At that time, a career as a civil servant was a glittering prize for an African, the highest that a black man could aspire to. In the rural areas, an interpreter in the magistrate's office was considered second only in importance to the magistrate himself. When, in my second year, Fort Hare introduced an interpreting course taught by a distinguished retired court interpreter, Tayamshe, I was one of the first students to sign up. Fort Hare could be a rather elitist place, and was not without the hazing common to many institutions of higher learning. Upperclassmen treated their juniors with haughtiness and disdain. When I first arrived on campus, I spotted Gamaliel Vabaza across the central courtyard. He was several years older, and I had been with him at Clarkbury. I greeted him warmly, but his response was exceedingly cool and superior, and he made a disparaging remark about the fact that I would be staying in the freshman dormitory. Vabaza then informed me that he was on the house committee of my dormitory, even though, as a senior, he no longer shared the dormitory. I found this odd and undemocratic, but it was the accepted practice. One night, not long after that, a group of us discussed the fact that no residents or freshmen were represented on the house committee. We decided that we should depart from tradition and elect a house committee made up of these two groups. We caucused among ourselves and lobbied all the residents of the house, and within weeks elected our own house committee, defeating the upperclassmen. I myself was one of the organizers and was elected to this newly constituted committee. But the upperclassmen were not so easily subdued. They held a meeting at which one of them, Rex Titani, an eloquent English speaker, said, "This behavior on the part of freshers is unacceptable. How can we seniors be overthrown by a backward fellow from the countryside like Mandela, a fellow who cannot even speak English properly?" Then he proceeded to mimic the way I spoke, giving me what he perceived to be a Kakleka accent, at which his own clack laughed heartily. Titani's sneering speech made us all more resolute. We freshers now constituted the official house committee, and we assigned the seniors the most unpleasant chores, which was a humiliation for them. The warden of the college, Reverend A. J. Cook, learned of this dispute and called us into his office. We felt we had right on our side and were not prepared to yield. Titani appealed to the warden to overrule us and, in the midst of his speech, broke down and wept. The warden asked us to modify our stand, but we would not bend. Like most bullies, Titani had a brittle but fragile exterior. We informed the warden that if he overruled us, we would all resign from the House Committee, depriving the committee itself of any integrity or authority. In the end, the warden decided not to intervene. We had remained firm, and we had won. This was one of my first battles with authority, and I felt the sense of power that comes from having right and justice on one side. I would not be so lucky in the future in my fight against the authorities at the college. My education at Fort Hare was as much outside as inside the classroom. I was a more active sportsman than I had been at Healdtown. This was due to two factors. I had grown taller and stronger, But more important, Fort Hare was so much smaller than Healdtown. I had less competition. I was able to compete in both soccer and cross-country running. Running taught me valuable lessons. In cross-country competition, training counted more than intrinsic ability, and I could compensate for a lack of natural aptitude with diligence and discipline. I applied this in everything I did. Even as a student, I saw many young men who had great natural ability, but who did not have the self-discipline and patience to build on their endowment. I also joined the Drama Society and acted in a play about Abraham Lincoln that was adapted by my classmate Lincoln Mkentane. Mkentane came from a distinguished Transkayan family and was another fellow whom I looked up to. This was literally true, as he was the only student at Fort Hare taller than I was. Mkentane portrayed his namesake while I played John Wilkes Booth, Lincoln's assassin. Mkentane's depiction of Lincoln was stately and formal, and his recitation of one of the greatest of all speeches, the Gettysburg Address, won a standing ovation. My part was the smaller one, though I was the engine of the play's moral, which was that men who take great risks often suffer great consequences. I became a member of the Students' Christian Association and taught Bible classes on Sundays in neighboring villages. One of my comrades on these expeditions was a serious young science scholar whom I had met on the soccer field. He came from Pondoland in the Transkei, and his name was Oliver Tambo. From the start, I saw that Oliver's intelligence was diamond-edged. He was a keen debater and did not accept the platitudes that so many of us automatically subscribed to. Oliver lived in Beta Hall, the Anglican hostel, and though I did not have much contact with him at Fort Hare, it was easy to see that he was destined for great things. On Sundays, a group of us would sometimes walk into Alice to have a meal at one of the restaurants in town. The restaurant was run by whites, and in those days it was inconceivable for a black man to walk in the front door, much less take a meal in the dining hall. Instead, we would pool our resources, go round to the kitchen, and order what we wanted. I not only learned about physics at Fort Hare, but another precise physical science, ballroom dancing. To a crackly old phonograph in the dining hall, we spent hours practicing foxtrots and waltzes, each of us taking turns leading and following. Our idol was Victor Sylvester, the world champion of ballroom dancing, and our tutor was a fellow student, Smalley Siwundla, who seemed a younger version of the master. In a neighboring village, there was an African dance hall known as Nselemanzi, which catered to the cream of local black society and was off-limits to undergraduates. But one night, desperate to practice our steps with the gentler sex, we put on our suits, stole out of our dormitory, and made it to the dance hall. It was a sumptuous place, and we felt very daring. I noticed a lovely young woman across the floor and politely asked her to dance. A moment later, she was in my arms. We moved well together, and I imagined what a striking figure I was cutting on the floor. After a few minutes, I asked her her name. "Mrs. Bokwe," she said softly. I almost dropped her right there and scampered off the floor. I glanced across the floor and saw Dr. Rosebery Bokwe, one of the most respected African leaders and scholars of the time, chatting with his brother-in-law and my professor, Z.K. Matthews. I apologized to Mrs. Bokwe, and then sheepishly escorted her to the side under the curious eyes of Dr. Bokwe and Professor Matthews. I wanted to sink beneath the floorboards. I had violated any number of university regulations, but Professor Matthews, who was in charge of discipline at Fort Hare, never said a word to me. He was willing to tolerate what he considered high spirits as long as it was balanced by hard work. I don't think I ever studied more diligently than in the weeks after our evening at Nselemanzi. Fort Hare was characterized by a level of sophistication, both intellectual and social, that was new and strange to me. By Western standards, Fort Hare's worldliness may not seem like much, but to a country boy like myself, it was a revelation. I wore pajamas for the first time, finding them uncomfortable in the beginning, but gradually growing used to them. I had never used a toothbrush and toothpaste before. At home, we used ash to whiten our teeth and toothpicks to clean them. The water flush toilets and hot water showers were also a novelty to me. I used toilet soap for the first time, not the blue detergent that I had washed with for so many years at home. Perhaps as a result of all this unfamiliarity, I yearned for some of the simple pleasures that I had known as a boy. I was not alone in this feeling, and I joined a group of young men who engaged in secret evening expeditions to the university's farmland, where we built a fire and roasted mealies. We would then sit around, eating the ears of corn and telling tall tales. We did not do this because we were hungry, but out of a need to recapture what was most homelike to us. We boasted about our conquests, our athletic prowess, and how much money we were going to make once we had graduated. Although I felt myself to be a sophisticated young fellow, I was still a country boy who missed country pleasures. While Fort Hare was a sanctuary removed from the world, we were keenly interested in the progress of World War II. Like my classmates, I was an ardent supporter of Great Britain, and I was enormously excited to learn that the speaker at the university's graduation ceremony at the end of my first year would be England's great advocate in South Africa, the former Prime Minister, Jan Smuts. It was a great honor for Fort Hare to play host to a man acclaimed as a world statesman. Smuts, then Deputy Prime Minister, was campaigning around the country for South Africa to declare war on Germany, while the Prime Minister, J.B. Herzog, advocated neutrality. I was extremely curious to see a world leader like Smuts from up close. While Herzog had, 3 years earlier, led the drive to remove the last African voters from the common voters' roll in the Cape, I found Smuts a sympathetic figure. I cared more that he had helped found the League of Nations, promoting freedom around the world, than the fact that he had repressed freedom at home. Smuts spoke about the importance of supporting Great Britain against the Germans and the idea that England stood for the same Western values that we, as South Africans, stood for. I remember thinking that his accent in English was almost as poor as mine. Along with my fellow classmates, I heartily applauded him, cheering Smuts's call to do battle for the freedom of Europe, forgetting that we did not have that freedom here in our own land. Smuts was preaching to the converted at Fort Hare. Each evening, the warden of Wesley House used to review the military situation in Europe, and late at night, we would huddle around an old radio and listen to BBC broadcasts of Winston Churchill's stirring speeches. But even though we supported Smuts's position, his visit provoked much discussion. During one session, a contemporary of mine, Nayati Kongisa, who was considered an extremely clever fellow, condemned Smuts as a racist. He said that we might consider ourselves black Englishmen, but the English had oppressed us at the same time they tried to civilize us. Whatever the mutual antagonism between Boer and British, he said, the two white groups would unite to confront the black threat. Kongisa's views stunned us and seemed dangerously radical. A fellow student whispered to me that Nayathi was a member of the African National Congress, an organization that I had vaguely heard of but knew very little about. Following South Africa's declaration of war against Germany, Herzog resigned, and Smuts became Prime Minister. During my second year at Fort Hare, I invited my friend Paul Mahabani to spend the winter holidays with me in the Transkei. Paul was from Bloemfontein and was well known on campus because his father, the Reverend Zacchaeus Mahabani, had twice been President General of the African National Congress. His connection to this organization, about which I still knew very little, gave him the reputation of a rebel. One day, during the holiday, Paul and I went to Umtata, the capital of the Transkei, which then consisted of a few paved streets and some government buildings. We were standing outside the post office when the local magistrate, a white man in his 60s, approached Paul and asked him to go inside to buy him some postage stamps. It was quite common for any white person to call on any black person to perform a chore. The magistrate attempted to hand Paul some change, but Paul would not take it. The magistrate was offended. "Do you know who I am?" he said, his face turning red with irritation. "It is not necessary to know who you are," Mahabani said. "I know what you are." The magistrate asked him exactly what he meant by that. "I mean that you are a rogue," Paul said heatedly. The magistrate boiled over and exclaimed, "You'll pay dearly for this," and then walked away. I was extremely uncomfortable with Paul's behavior. While I respected his courage, I also found it disturbing. The magistrate knew precisely who I was, and I know that if he had asked me rather than Paul, I would have simply performed the errand and forgotten about it. But I admired Paul for what he had done, even though I was not yet ready to do the same thing myself. I was beginning to realize that a black man did not have to accept the dozens of petty indignities directed at him each day. After my holiday, I returned to school early in the new year, feeling strong and renewed. I concentrated on my studies, pointing toward examinations in October. In a year's time, I imagined that I would have a B.A., just like clever Gertrude Ntlabati. A university degree, I believed, was a passport not only to community leadership, but to financial success. We had been told over and over again by the principal, Dr. Alexander Kerr, and Professors Jabavu and Matthews, how, as graduates of Fort Hare, we were the African elite. I believed that the world would be at my feet. As a B.A., I would finally be able to restore to my mother the wealth and prestige that she had lost after my father's death. I would build her a proper home in Kounou, with a garden and modern furniture and fittings. I would support her and my sisters so that they could afford the things that they had so long been denied. This was my dream, and it seemed within reach. During that year, I was nominated to stand for the Student Representative Council, which was the highest student organization at Fort Hare. I did not know at the time that the events surrounding a student election would create difficulties that would change the course of my life. The SRC elections were held in the final term of the year, while we were in the midst of examination preparations. According to the Fort Hare Constitution, the entire student body elected the 6 members of the SRC. Shortly before the election, a meeting of all students was held to discuss problems and voice our grievances. The students unanimously felt that the diet at Fort Hare was unsatisfactory and that the powers of the SRC needed to be increased so that it would be more than a rubber stamp for the administration. I agreed with both motions, and when a majority of students voted to boycott the elections unless the authorities accepted our demands, I voted with them. Shortly after this meeting, the scheduled voting took place. The lion's share of students boycotted the election, but 25 students, about one-sixth of the student body, showed up and elected 6 representatives, one of whom was myself. That same day, the 6 elected in absentia met to discuss these events. We unanimously decided to tender our resignations on the grounds that we supported the boycott and did not enjoy the support of the majority of the students. We then drafted a letter, which we handed to Dr. Kerr. But Dr. Kerr was clever. He accepted our resignations and then announced that new elections were to be held the next day in the dining hall at supper time. This would ensure that all the students would be present and that there would be no excuse that the SRC did not have the support of the entire student body. That evening, the election was held, as the principal ordered, but only the same 25 voted, returning the same 6 SRC members. It would seem we were back where we started. Only this time, when the 6 of us met to consider our position, the voting was very different. My 5 colleagues held to the technical view that we had been elected at a meeting in which all students were present, and therefore we could no longer argue that we did not represent the student body. The 5 believed we should now accept office. I countered that nothing, in fact, had changed. While all the students had been there, a majority of them had not voted, and it would be morally incorrect to say that we enjoyed their confidence. Since our initial goal was to boycott the election, an action that had the confidence of the student body, our duty was still to abide by that resolution and not be deterred by some trickery on the part of the principal. Unable to persuade my colleagues, I resigned for the 2nd time, the only one of the 6 to do so. The following day, I was called in to see the principal. Dr. Kerr, a graduate of Edinburgh University, was virtually the founder of Fort Hare and was a greatly respected man. He calmly reviewed the events of the past few days and then asked me to reconsider my decision to resign. I told him I could not. He told me to sleep on it and give him my final decision the following day. He did warn me, however, that he could not allow his students to act irresponsibly, and he said that if I insisted on resigning, he would be compelled to expel me from Fort Hare. I was shaken by what he had said, and I spent a restless night. I had never had to make such a consequential decision before. That evening, I consulted with my friend and mentor, K.D., who felt that as a matter of principle, I was correct to resign and should not capitulate. I think at the time I feared K.D. even more than I did Dr. Kerr. I thanked K.D. and returned to my room. Even though I thought what I was doing was morally right, I was still uncertain as to whether it was the correct course. Was I sabotaging my academic career over an abstract moral principle that mattered very little? I found it difficult to swallow the idea that I would sacrifice what I regarded as my obligation to the students for my own selfish interests. I had taken a stand, and I did not want to appear to be a fraud in the eyes of my fellow students. At the same time, I did not want to throw away my career at Fort Hare. I was in a state of indecision when I reached Dr. Kerr's office the next morning. It was only when he asked me if I had reached a decision that I actually made up my mind. I told him that I had, and that I could not in good conscience serve on the SRC. Dr. Kerr seemed a bit taken aback by my response. He thought for a moment or two before speaking. "Very well," he said. "It is your decision, of course, but I have also given the matter some thought, and I propose to you the following. You may return to Fort Hare next year, provided you join the SRC. You have all summer to consider it, Mr. Mandela." I was, in a way, as surprised by my response as Dr. Kerr. I knew it was foolhardy for me to leave Fort Hare, but at the moment I needed to compromise, I simply could not do so. Something inside me would not let me. While I appreciated Dr. Kerr's position and his willingness to give me another chance, I resented his absolute power over my fate. I should have had every right to resign from the SRC if I wished. This injustice rankled, and at that moment I saw Dr. Kerr less as a benefactor than as a not altogether benign dictator. When I left Fort Hare at the end of the year, I was in an unpleasant state of limbo. Chapter 8. Usually, when I returned to Nkizweni, I did so with a sense of ease and completion, but not so this time. After passing my exams and returning home, I told the regent what had transpired. He was furious and could not comprehend the reasons for my actions. He thought it utterly senseless. Without even hearing my full explanation, he bluntly informed me that I would obey the principal's instructions and return to Fort Hare in the fall. His tone invited no discussion.
It would have been pointless as well as disrespectful for me to debate my benefactor. I resolved to let the matter rest for a while. Justice had also returned to Imkazweni, and we were mightily glad to see one another. No matter how long Justice and I were apart, the brotherly bonds that united us were instantly renewed. Justice had left school the year before and was living in Cape Town. Within a few days, I resumed my old life at home. I looked after matters for the regent, including his herd and his relations with other chiefs. I did not dwell on the situation at Fort Hare, but life has a way of forcing decisions on those who vacillate. It was an entirely different matter, unrelated to my studies, that forced my hand. A few weeks after my homecoming, the regent summoned Justice and me to a meeting. "My children," he said in a very somber tone, "I fear that I am not much longer for this world, and before I journey to the land of the ancestors, it is my duty to see my two sons properly married. I have, accordingly, arranged unions for both of you." This announcement took us both by surprise, and Justice and I looked at each other with a mixture of shock and helplessness. "The two girls came from very good families," the regent said. "Justice was to marry the daughter of Kalipa, a prominent Tembu nobleman, and Holihlahla, as the regent always called me, was to marry the daughter of the local Tembu priest. The marriages," he said, "were to take place immediately. Lobola, the bride price, or dowry, is normally paid in the form of cattle by the groom's father, and would be paid by the community in Justice's case, and in my own by the regent himself." Justice and I said little. It was not our place to question the regent, and as far as he was concerned, the matter was settled. The regent brooked no discussion. The bride had already been selected and Lobola paid. It was final. Justice and I walked out of our interview with our heads down, dazed and dejected. The regent was acting in accordance with Tembu law and custom, and his own motives could not be maligned. He wanted us to be settled during his lifetime. We had always known that the regent had the right to arrange marriages for us, but now it was no longer an abstract possibility. The brides were not fantasies, but flesh and blood women whom we actually knew. With all due respect to the young woman's family, I would be dishonest if I said that the girl the regent had selected for me was my dream bride. Her family was prominent and respected, and she was attractive in a rather dignified way. But this young lady, I am afraid, had long been in love with Justice. The regent would not have known this, as parents rarely know the romantic side of their children's lives. My intended partner was undoubtedly no more eager to be burdened with me than I was with her. At that time, I was more advanced socially than politically. While I would not have considered fighting the political system of the white man, I was quite prepared to rebel against the social system of my own people. Ironically, it was the regent himself who was indirectly to blame for this, for it was the education he had afforded me that had caused me to reject such traditional customs. I had attended college and university with women for years and had had a small handful of love affairs. I was a romantic, and I was not prepared to have anyone, even the regent, select a bride for me. I made an appointment with the queen, the regent's wife, and put my case to her. I could not tell her that I did not want the regent to arrange a bride for me under any circumstances, as she would naturally have been unsympathetic. Instead, I devised an alternative plan and told her that I preferred to marry a girl who was a relative of the queen's, whom I found desirable as a prospective partner. This young lady was, in fact, very attractive,
but I had no idea as to what she thought of me. I said I would marry her as soon as I completed my studies. This was half a ruse, but it was a better alternative than the regent's plan. The queen took my side in the matter, but the regent could not be dissuaded. He had made his decision, and he was not going to alter it. I felt as though he had left me no choice. I could not go through with this marriage, which I considered unfair and ill-advised. At the same time, I believed that I could no longer remain under the regent's guidance if I rejected his plan for me. Justice agreed, and the two of us decided that the only option remaining was to run away, and the only place to run to was Johannesburg. In retrospect, I realized that we did not exhaust all the options available to us. I could have attempted to discuss the matter with the regent through intermediaries and perhaps come to some settlement within the framework of our tribe and family. I could have appealed to the regent's cousin, Chief Zilindlovu, one of the most enlightened and influential chiefs at the court of Nkgizweni. But I was young and impatient, and did not see any virtue in waiting. Escape seemed the only course. We kept our plot secret as we worked out its details. First, we needed an opportunity. The regent believed Justice and I brought out the worst in each other, or at least Justice's penchant for adventures and hijinks influenced my more conservative disposition. As a result, he took pains to keep us separate as much as possible. When the regent was traveling, he generally asked one of us to accompany him so that we would not be alone together in his absence. More often than not, he took Justice with him, as he liked me to remain in Nkgizweni to look after his affairs. But we learned that the regent was preparing to leave for a full week to attend a session of the Bunga, the Transkeian Legislative Assembly, without either of us, and we decided that this was the ideal time to steal away. We resolved that we would depart for Johannesburg shortly after the regent left for the Bunga. I had few clothes, and we managed to get whatever we had in a single suitcase. The regent left early on Monday, and by late morning we were ready to go. But just as we were preparing to leave, the regent unexpectedly returned. We saw his car drive in, and we ran into the garden and hid among the mealie stalks. The regent came into the house, and his first question was, "Where are those boys?" Someone replied, "Oh, they are around." But the regent was suspicious and was not content with that explanation. He had returned, he said, because he had forgotten to take his Epsom salts. He looked around a bit and then seemed satisfied. I realized that he must have had some kind of premonition because he could easily buy Epsom salts in town. When his car disappeared behind the hills, we were on our way. We had almost no money between us, but that morning we went to see a local trader and made a deal to sell him two of the regent's prize oxen. The trader assumed that we were selling the animals at the regent's behest, and we did not correct him. He paid us a very good price, and with that money we hired a car to take us to the local train station where we would catch a train to Johannesburg. All seemed to be going smoothly. But unbeknown to us, the regent had driven to the local train station and instructed the manager that if two boys fitting our description came to buy tickets for Johannesburg, the manager must turn them away because we were not to leave the Transkei. We arrived at the station only to find that the manager would not sell us tickets. We asked him why, and he said, "Your father has been here and says you are trying to run away." We were stunned by this, and dashed back to our hired car and told him to drive to the next station. It was nearly 50 miles away, and it took us more than an hour to get there. We managed to get on a train there, but it only went as far as Queenstown. In the 1940s, traveling for an African was a complicated process. All Africans over the age of 16 were compelled to carry native passes issued by the Native Affairs Department and were required to show that pass to any white policeman, civil servant, or employer. Failure to do so could mean arrest, trial, a jail sentence, or fine. The pass stated where the bearer lived, who his chief was, and whether he had paid the annual poll tax, which was a tax levied only on Africans. Later, the pass took the form of a booklet, or reference book, as it was known, containing detailed information that had to be signed by one's employer every month. Justice and I had our passes in order, but for an African to leave his magisterial district and enter that of another for the purpose of working or living, he needed traveling documents, a permit,
and a letter from his employer, or, as in our case, his guardian, none of which we had. Even at the best of times, when one had all these documents, a police officer might harass you because one was missing a signature or had an incorrect date. Not having any of them was extremely risky. Our plan was to disembark in Queenstown and make our way to the house of a relative and then make arrangements for the necessary documents. This was also an ill-considered plan, but we came in for a bit of luck, because at the house in Queenstown we accidentally met Chief Mpondombini, a brother of the regent's, who was fond of justice and myself. Chief Mpondombini greeted us warmly, and we explained that we needed the requisite travel documents from the local magistrate. We lied about why we required them, claiming that we were on an errand for the regent. Chief Mpondombini was a retired interpreter from the Native Affairs Department and knew the chief magistrate well. He had no reason to doubt our story and not only escorted us to the magistrate, but vouched for us and explained our predicament. After listening to the chief, the magistrate rapidly made out the necessary traveling documents and affixed the official stamp. Justice and I looked at each other and smiled in complicity. But just as the magistrate was handing over the documents to us, he recalled something and said that, as a matter of courtesy, he ought to inform the chief magistrate of Umtata, in whose jurisdiction we fell. This made us uneasy, but we stayed seated in his office. The magistrate cranked the telephone and reached his colleague in Umtata. As luck would have it, the regent was just then paying a call on the chief magistrate of Umtata and was in his very office. As our magistrate was explaining our situation to the chief magistrate of Umtata, the latter gentleman said something like, "Oh, their father just happens to be right here," and then put the regent on the telephone. When the magistrate informed the regent what we were requesting, the regent exploded. "Arrest those boys!" he shouted, loud enough that we could hear his voice through the receiver. "Arrest them and bring them back here immediately." The chief magistrate put down the phone. He regarded us angrily. "You boys are thieves and liars," he told us. "You have presumed upon my good offices and then deceived me. Now I am going to have you arrested." I immediately rose to our defense. From my studies at Fort Hare, I had a little knowledge of law, and I put it to use. I said that we had told him lies, that was true, but we had committed no offense and violated no laws, and we could not be arrested simply on the recommendation of a chief, even if he happened to be our father. The magistrate backed off and did not arrest us, but told us to leave his office and never to darken his door again. Chief Mpondombini was also annoyed and left us to our own devices. Justice remembered that he had a friend in Queenstown named Sidney who was working in the office of a white attorney. We went to see this fellow, explained our situation, and he told us that the mother of the attorney he worked for was driving into Johannesburg, and he would see if she would offer us a lift. He told us that his mother would give us a ride if we paid a fee of £15 sterling. This was a vast sum, far more than the cost of a train ticket. The fee virtually depleted our savings, but we had no choice. We decided to risk getting our passes stamped and the correct travel documents once we were in Johannesburg. We left early the following morning.
In those days, it was customary for blacks to ride in the back seat of the car if a white was driving. The two of us sat in that fashion, with Justice directly behind the woman. Justice was a friendly, exuberant person, and immediately began chatting to me. This made the old woman extremely uncomfortable. She had obviously never been in the company of a black who had no inhibitions around whites. After only a few miles, she told Justice that she wanted him to switch seats with me, so that she could keep an eye on him. And for the rest of the journey, she watched him like a hawk. But after a while, Justice's charm worked on her, and she would occasionally laugh at something he said. At about 10 o'clock that evening, we saw before us, glinting in the distance, a maze of lights that seemed to stretch in all directions. Electricity, to me, had always been a novelty and a luxury, and here was a vast landscape of electricity, a city of light. I was terribly excited to see the city I had been hearing about since I was a child. Johannesburg had always been depicted as a city of dreams, a place where one could transform oneself from a poor peasant to a wealthy sophisticate, a city of danger and of opportunity. I remembered the stories that Banabake had told us at circumcision school, of buildings so tall you could not see the tops, of crowds of people speaking languages you had never heard of sleek motor cars and beautiful women and dashing gangsters. It was Igoli, the city of gold, where I would soon be making my home. On the outskirts of the city, the traffic became denser. I had never seen so many cars on the road at one time, even in Umtata. There were never more than a handful of cars, and here there were thousands. We drove around the city rather than through it, but I could see the silhouette of the tall, blocky buildings even darker against the dark night sky. I looked at great billboards by the side of the road, advertising cigarettes and candy and beer. It all seemed tremendously glamorous. Soon we were in an area of stately mansions, even the smallest of which was bigger than the Regent's Palace, with grand front lawns and tall iron gates. This was the suburb where the old lady's daughter lived, and we pulled into the long driveway of one of these beautiful homes. Justice and I were dispatched to the servants' wing, where we were to spend the night. We thanked the old lady, and then crawled off to sleep on the floor. But the prospect of Johannesburg was so exciting to me that I felt like I slept on a beautiful feather bed that night. The possibilities seemed infinite. I had reached the end of what seemed like a long journey, but was actually the very beginning of a much longer and more trying journey that would test me in ways that I could not then have imagined. Part 2. Johannesburg. Chapter 9. It was dawn when we reached the offices of Crown Mines, which were located on the plateau of a great hill overlooking the still dark metropolis. Johannesburg was a city built up around the discovery of gold on the Witwatersrand in 1886, and Crown Mines was the largest gold mine in the City of Gold. I expected to see a grand building like the government offices in Umtata, but the Crown Mine offices were rusted tin shanties on the face of the mine. There is nothing magical about a gold mine. Barren and pockmarked, all dirt and no trees, fenced in on all sides, a gold mine resembles a war-torn battlefield. The noise was harsh and ubiquitous. The rasp of shaft lifts, the jangling power drills, the distant rumble of dynamite, the barked orders. Everywhere I looked, I saw black men in dusty overalls looking tired and bent. They lived on the grounds in bleak, single-sex barracks that contained hundreds of concrete bunks separated from each other by only a few inches. Gold mining on the Witwatersrand was costly because the ore was low-grade and deep under the earth. only the presence of cheap labor in the form of thousands of Africans working long hours for little pay with no rights made gold mining profitable for the mining houses. White-owned companies that became wealthy beyond the dreams of Croesus on the backs of the African people. I had never seen such enterprise before, such great machines, such methodical organization, and such back-breaking work. It was my first sight of South African capitalism at work, and I knew I was in for a new kind of education. We went straight to the chief Induna, or head man. His name was Piliso, a tough old fellow who had seen life at its most pitiless. Piliso knew about justice, as the regent had sent a letter months before making arrangements for him to receive a clerical job, the most coveted and respected job in the mine compound. I, however, was unknown to him. Justice explained that I was his brother. "I was expecting only justice," Piliso responded. "Your father's letter mentions nothing about a brother." He looked me over rather skeptically, but Justice pleaded with him, saying it had simply been an oversight and that the regent had already posted a letter about me. Piliso's crusty exterior hid a sympathetic side, and he took me on as a mine policeman, saying that if I worked out, he would give me a clerical post in 3 months' time. The regent's word carried weight at Crown Mines. This was true of all chiefs in South Africa. Mining officials were eager to recruit labor in the countryside, and the chiefs had authority over the men they needed. They wanted the chiefs to encourage their subjects to come to the reef. The chiefs were treated with great deference. The mining houses provided special lodgings for them whenever they came to visit. One letter from the regent was enough to secure a man a good job, and Justice and I were treated with extra care because of our connection. We were to be given free rations, sleeping quarters, and a small salary. We did not stay in the barracks that first night. For our first few days, Piliso, out of courtesy to the regent, invited Justice and me to stay with him. Many of the miners, especially those from Tembuland, treated Justice as a chief and greeted him with gifts of cash, the custom when a chief visited a mine. Most of these men were in the same hostel. Miners were normally housed according to tribe. The mining companies preferred such segregation because it prevented different ethnic groups from uniting around a common grievance and reinforced the power of the chiefs. The separation often resulted in factional fights between different ethnic groups and clans, which the companies did not effectively discourage. Justice shared some of his booty with me and gave me a few extra pounds as a bonus. For those first few days, my pockets jingling with newfound riches, I felt like a millionaire. I was beginning to think I was a child of fortune, that luck was shining on me, and that if I had not wasted precious time studying at college, I could have been a wealthy man by then. Once again, I did not see that fate was busy setting snares around me. I started working immediately as a night watchman. I was given a uniform, a new pair of boots, a helmet, a flashlight, a whistle, and a knobkerrie, which is a long wooden stick with a heavy ball of wood at one end. The job was a simple one. I waited at the compound's entrance next to the sign that read, "Beware, natives crossing here," and checked the credentials of all those entering and leaving. For the first few nights, I patrolled the grounds of the compound without incident. I did challenge a rather drunken miner late one evening, but he meekly showed his pass and retired to his hostel. Flushed with our success, Justice and I boasted of our cleverness to a friend of ours whom we knew from home who was also working at the mines. We explained how we had run away and tricked the regent in the bargain. Although we swore this fellow to secrecy, he went straight away to the Induna and revealed our secret. A day later, Piliso called us in, and the first question he asked Justice was, "Where is the permission from the regent for your brother?" Justice said that he had already explained the Ferigent had posted it. Peliso was not mollified by this, and we sensed that something was wrong. He then reached inside his desk and produced a telegram. I have had a communication from the